Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday, Donald Trump traveled to Kenosha, Wisconsin to attempt to change the conversation from racial justice and police violence to what he calls law and order. But Jacob Blake's family says they're not having it. They held a community gathering with dancing, free haircuts, cleanup crews, and a voter registration table. Last Monday, police shot Jacob Blake in the back 7 times as he attempted to enter his SUV. Jacob is a 29-year-old black father. 3 of his children were in the car when he was shot. His family says he is now paralyzed from the waist down. And this is why hundreds of thousands of people have been taking to the streets in cities across the country. Last Friday, tens of thousands of people gathered on the National Mall to mark the anniversary of the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Last Friday's march was called Get Your Knee Off Our Necks. Family members of Jacob Blake, Breonna Taylor, Eric Garner, Botham Jean, Oscar Grant, and so many more spoke at the rally, many encouraging people to go to the polls in November. They also called for racial justice. Joining us now are 3 guests. Gregory McKelvey is vice chair of Oregon Democratic Black Caucus and board president of Brown Hope, a nonprofit and community solution for racial justice. Gregory was born and raised in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Gregory. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you back. We're also joined by Jamelia Land, a children's mental health advocate who works with All of Us or None, a California-based grassroots organization fighting for the rights of formerly and currently incarcerated people. Jamelia was a close family friend of 22-year-old Stephon Clark, who was shot and killed by 2 police officers in his grandmother's yard in Sacramento in March 2018. Officers said they thought Stephon was holding a gun, but it turned out to be a cell phone. Hi, Jamelia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. Reggie Jackson is a senior columnist with the Milwaukee Independent, an award-winning news magazine that advocates for inclusive social understanding in Milwaukee. Hi, Reggie. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here with you, Rose. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. And I want to start off with you, Reggie, because I spoke with a local activist who was on the streets the night that Kyle Rittenhouse, the 17-year-old self-described member of a militia, shot 3 people and killed 2. And he said, you know, I just cannot join your show because we are so traumatized by what we saw on the streets. He said, I gotta take a break. I just can't do this. It's just too much every single day. So I'm just wondering, what are you hearing from people on the ground? I mean, it's, you know, the news cycle moves so fast, but it's so intense to think that so many activists were on the ground with all these armed men, and then one of them allegedly shot 3 and killed 2.
You know, people that I've spoken to, there have been a lot of activists who've been fighting for police reform in the city of Milwaukee and in our capital of Madison, you know, many cities around the state that I've been, you know, doing work with over a number of years, who went down to Kenosha after Jacob Blake was shot. To support that community, to support Jacob Blake and his family. And they saw immediately, they saw armed white men there. Because, I mean, this one of the things that bothers me is that we're not calling these people out. We're not saying that they're white. These are armed white men who are calling themselves counter-protesters. And, you know, this young man who murdered these 2 individuals, not only was he hanging out with the county sheriff's department earlier that day with a group of other armed white men, getting bottled water from them and having the authorities tell them, you know, thank you for your help. You know, these people see themselves as vigilantes. They think that this is 1888 all over again, where you can be deputized by the authorities and you can walk around as if you're a police officer. That's what was in his mind. And people that I know who were there in the days leading up to it and who were there that night, these people are terrified. They are so afraid of the next time this happens, because we know this won't be the last time. We saw in Charlottesville the activities there which led to the death of a young woman. And now we've seen the death of these 2 individuals in Kenosha. People are really afraid because what they're seeing are armed police officers. They're seeing armed, you know, National Guardsmen. And now they're seeing armed civilians. And they just feel like there's no protection for the peaceful protesters. And they almost see the police coddling this young man. He shoots and kills two individuals. He walks towards the police vehicle with his arms in the air, you know, with the universally recognized signal of "I give up." And they just drove right past him because they didn't see him as a threat. And that's part of the problem.
We played the clip last week of National Guards handing water out to these guys, including 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse, saying, "We appreciate you guys." Have you learned anything else about the relationship between these white armed militiamen and the National Guard or the local police?
Well, I think the relationship they have is a relationship that they've had across the country. When you look back to the early part of the pandemic, when people were protesting the closing of the economy in Michigan, armed white men stormed the Capitol building in Michigan, and the police really didn't do anything to stop them. We've seen this type of activity. We've seen police departments really support these individuals and not treat them the same as they treat, you know, peaceful protesters who are unarmed. And we know from long years of experience in the black community that we will not be allowed to just walk around randomly with assault rifles and other weapons without being accosted by the police. Whereas these men and women and children who think they can just freely walk around, the police have shown them that, listen, we're okay with you guys doing this. They have not, you know, shot them with rubber bullets or tear gas these individuals. They see them as compatriots in this battle against people who are peaceful protesters.
And I just want to mention the names of the people who were shot and two killed. Joseph Rosenbaum and Anthony Huber were shot and killed, and Gage Grossgritz was shot. And I got these names from U.S. News and World Report. Michael German, a former FBI special agent who's now with the Brennan Center, says that white supremacists and militias have infiltrated police, every aspect of law enforcement agencies in every region of the country over the last two decades. And we're going to talk more about that in depth on tomorrow's show. Let's go to Portland. And Gregory, before we get into what we know and don't know about what happened last Saturday in Portland, when someone was shot and killed, Aaron Danielson, who allegedly is a member of a far-right group, how are people in Portland doing? Because, gosh, the protests have been happening for over 80 days. You tweeted so many videos of police just grabbing people, slamming them to the ground, going up to a huge group of press people and saying, if you don't have a press pass, you will be arrested immediately. Could just give us a sense of what's happening still on the ground in Portland.
I mean, it literally, all of Portland is waking up to the same videos every single day, and we're so used to it, but I think the city is still so outraged. We wake up to videos of, yes, graffiti sometimes, and even sometimes a dumpster fire. And then one day we woke up to a death in our streets, but we also wake up to extreme police brutality, charging of the crowd, mass arrests, police officers hitting people in the head with batons. And so we're close to 100 days straight of these protests, and it doesn't seem like they're going to let up anytime soon, because each protest isn't just about all of the killings that have happened nationally or in Portland, but also a protest of the previous night's actions of Portland police.
And what are you hearing from people who are taking to the streets night after night?
Well, a lot of them, you know, say they want to defund the police, but really, I mean, substantively, they just want change. They want something to change. And the easiest example that they have that nothing is changing is that people are still getting beat in the streets for just saying that they want change. It's clear that Portland police do not view themselves as a legitimate target for protest. And when we saw a weekend where Trump supporters came into town, we saw them do a boat parade where the wake of that parade collapsed a family's boat. We saw them come into town another time and really terrorize our city with fights and pepper spray. And then we saw them come the day that there was that unfortunate death as well. but none of those protests by Trump supporters saw hardly any police presence, if any at all. And so as we see that disparate policing in the city, it really highlights the need for change, and that's why I think people are still going out every single day.
Right, and we should also mention the LA Times ran a piece last August about 1 in 1,000 black men and boys in the U.S. can expect to die at the hands of police. This is according to an analysis by Frank Edwards, a sociologist at Rutgers. It found that that makes them 2.5 times more likely than white men and boys to die during an encounter with cops. The analysis also showed that Latino men and boys, black women and girls, and Native American men, women, and children are killed by police at higher rates than their white peers. But the vulnerability of black men was particularly striking. Jamelia, what's going on in Sacramento? There have been many protests calling for justice over the shooting of Jacob Blake. Can you give us just an update on what's going on the streets of Sacramento?
Yes. So there's a lot of mixture of between protesting and vigilante behavior. I'd kind of like to go back a tad, if I may, and say that. Just listening to what you, the question you just posed around the statistics of African-American males being in the highest demographic of individuals that are being killed at the hands of law enforcement, and looking at overall systemic racism in this country and how much of a part it really plays, what I have been seeing here is, for the most part, we've been peaceful as far as legitimate protesting is concerned. It is the vigilante behavior that is occurring after dark that is problematic. We are seeing predominantly white males wearing riot gear, helmets. We have two distinctly different law enforcement agencies here. One is the Sacramento Police Department, which is headed by the city's first and only African-American chief of police, Daniel Hahn, who is also a very good friend of mine. And the other department is the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department, which is headed by Scott Jones. He did a press conference last week addressing these issues, and it felt like I was listening to Bull Connor. And so to hear some of the comments in regards to how various branches of law enforcement are engaging these specific demographic people of vigilantes is, I think that it's not exclusive or unique to any one particular city. I think that this is rooted in systemic racism in this country because, as I have said time and time again, a black life has absolutely no value in this place we call a country, which is actually I personally feel as though the United States of America is not a democracy or a country. It is a corporate capitalist society. We function as a corporation. Therefore, black lives have no value unless it's tied directly into this thing we call an economic engine, which is, in fact, this country. And so to see, to see law enforcement hand in hand, patting white vigilantes on the back, handing them out water, taking pictures with them, thanking them for their participation. It's terrifying, but it's not surprising because this is the country that we live in. We are founded and rooted in racism and hatred towards people who look like me. If it was the other way around, if blacks and Latinos took to the streets and they were armed, it would be a very different situation. And so what I'm seeing here is very similar to what I am seeing in other places throughout the country. What's most disturbing, however, is that we have these white vigilantes who are out here who are armed to the T. They are looting, rioting, they are, breaking windows, but they are intentionally spray painting BLM on buildings, on cars, wherever they can. And though the media, and I have to say this, is that the media plays a significant role in this, in that they only show certain images, They show BLM spray painted on a car that's been blown up on the side of a building. But they're not showing the images of the white vigilantes that are doing it. And so at the end of the day, people who look like me are being blamed for this type of behavior, though we may not be out there actively participating in it. And so, you know, it's devastating. But at the same time, we are tired. We are absolutely exhausted. And I don't think that white America is cognitive and aware of the depth of the trauma that we deal with. There isn't a day that goes by that I'm not getting a phone call from someone in the country asking me, have you seen the video? Are you familiar with this killing? You know, as a woman of color raising black children, albeit male and female, I'm constantly on edge. You know, it's a wonder that I am able to maintain my sanity, because at any given moment, I realize that I'm not safe. Whether I'm sitting in my home on my couch watching television, a stray bullet could come through the window, and it could come from a community member or it could come from law enforcement. If I'm in my car driving down the street, I could have someone from the community fire a bullet into my car, or I could be pulled over by law enforcement, and there's a 50-50 chance that I may or may not survive a routine traffic stop. You know, it's frightening. There isn't a day that goes by that I'm not concerned about the safety and welfare of my black sons. Every day I'm calling. You know, my oldest son is 28 years old, and I call him 4 or 5 times a day. Call me when you leave the house. Let me know where you're going. Like, he's 16 years old, because I'm terrified for his life. I now have a 5-month-old grandson, and the other day I was sitting and looking at him, and he's smiling, and I think, wow, he's so beautiful, so amazing. And then this fear came over me that at any given moment, this child's life could be taken merely because of the color of his skin. And so, you know, we have to teach our children about racism in this country before they even learn their ABCs. My 4-year-old daughter, we went to the gym right before coronavirus hit, and when I picked her up from the daycare, she had tears in her eyes and said, Mommy, what's wrong with me? I said, what do you mean? She says, that boy over there asked me what's wrong with my skin. Why am I so dark? Why am I burned? Have I been put in an oven? This was another 4-year-old white child. And so the reality of it, and, you know, we constantly, we bring up racism. We bring up the systemic issues in conversation, but we don't actually really dig into the heart of this thing. And that's what it is.
Jamelia, I mean, it's just, it hurts. I mean, you remind me, my niece just turned 10, and she's brown, not dark brown, but brown. And her little white friends ask her why she's so dark. I mean, this is just, you know, this is what people deal with every day.
Every day. And so when we see these things, we in the black community, and like I sit in a very interesting and unique situation, because Stephon Clark was killed at the hands of 2 police officers in Sacramento, that one of them was black. The chief of police is black, and he's one of my closest friends. And so what I have been doing has been intentionally walking in this space, trying to create change and a bridge. For example, Stevante Clark, who is the brother of Stephon, Stevante, Daniel Hahn, myself, we sat on a panel for the 2019 Annual Legislative Caucus in Washington, D.C., where we had these conversations. You know, I'm very aware that at any given time, you know, Daniel, who's black and male first, that his life can be taken, too, at the hands of law enforcement. It's very different being black in a blue uniform, you see, because you're going to get 1 of 2 or 3 responses. For us in the black community, it's either we're proud of you, thank you for trying to make a change, because we know that at the end of the day, you really can't, or you're every sellout, coon, overseer known to mankind. But the reality of it is, when he takes that uniform off, at any given moment, his life could be taken too. And in that uniform, no matter how much work he puts in behind that blue wall, he's still a nigger. Mm. And so what do we do? How do we address this? We talk about implicit bias training. Let's call it what it is. It's racism. It's not implicit bias. It's racism. Let's get away from these comfortable, cushy words that we use to try to make it more palatable for people to be able to look at and accept. We are a society that is rooted in hatred, that is rooted in racism. And I say it all the time, and I'll keep saying it, that my personal opinion and theory is this, that racism in this country is a socially created, psychologically indoctrinated mental health disease, and it impacts every single person that it touches.
Mm. Jamilia Land is a member of All of Us or None and a close family friend of Stephon Clark, who was shot and killed by police officers in Sacramento in March of 2018. We're also joined today by Reggie Jackson, senior columnist with the Milwaukee Independent, Gregory McKelvey, vice chair of the Oregon Democratic Black Caucus, and board president of Brown Hope, a nonprofit and community solution group for racial justice. And today we're having a wide-ranging conversation about why people are taking to the streets, what's happening on the streets with these white armed militia members coming out. Just last week, Kyle Rittenhouse allegedly shot three people in Kenosha and killed two. There was also a shooting in Portland. We don't have the specific details of that yet, but we're still waiting for that. If you have any questions for our guests about all of these issues, what are your thoughts about this moment that we're in right now? Trump going to Kenosha yesterday, refusing to talk about racial justice and saying, why are you changing the subject? We want to talk about violence and law and order. And we're just getting word from Axios that Joe Biden is going to Kenosha, it looks like tomorrow, to have a community conversation. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Reggie, Jamilia brought up a lot there. I want to ask you a question that's not getting much attention. NPR had a piece today where a reporter went and spoke with people who live in Kenosha and in an area where a lot of black owned businesses are. And a man walking down the street said, you know, this doesn't make sense. People who live here would not light these businesses on fire. According to the sheriff's own data, a majority of the people arrested in Kenosha since Jacob Blake's shooting are listed outside the city. And I'm seeing the same thing from officials in D.C. and a couple other cities. So can you talk more about this? And if that's the case, who are these people who are coming in and burning down independent businesses?
Well, you know, I call these individuals agents provocateurs. These are people that are coming in intentionally, just as Jamilia shared with us. They're doing things and making it seem as if black people are doing these things. When the protest started here after the George Floyd murder in Milwaukee, there was a Walgreens store that a fire was set inside of. A black woman who lives just a couple blocks away went in and put the fire out. And all we heard was that, you know, those Black Lives Matter protesters are trying to burn this Walgreens down in their own community, right? Well, guess what? We got surveillance footage from the Walgreens showing that it was a white person who set the fire. And people knew because they saw this white individual set the fire. They told the police that was somebody white who doesn't live in the neighborhood. Believe me, the neighborhood where Walgreens set on fire, white people do not set foot in that neighborhood to live. So we know that in community after community, these agent provocateurs are intentionally doing things like this, setting fires, looting, all of these things, blaming it on black people, but more specifically, blaming it on Black Lives Matter protesters. And I keep saying this, and I'll say it till the day that I die, as long as we continue to allow people to associate the peaceful protests that are occurring around the country, and we associate those actions with people that are setting fires and looting on purpose, then we're being disingenuous. We know that people are not going to go out and march for 2.5-3 hours peacefully in a coordinated attempt to show their disdain for what's happening in this country and then turn around and set a building on fire or loot a store. It just wouldn't make sense to even do that. And as I know a lot of the protest leaders here in the city of Milwaukee, I know some folks down in Kenosha. I've been working in Kenosha over a number of years, and I know the people that have been doing anti-racism work down there. They tell me that, listen, these are people from outside our community that really are trying very intentionally to make it worse than it should be, because they know that, you know, the media, listen, I hate to blast the media like this, but listen, these stories are much more nuanced than the media is putting out there. If they have boots on the ground, they can see what the protesters are seeing. They can see these white folks that are doing these things, spray painting Black Lives Matter, looting, doing all of these things with the intention of making the protest seem illegitimate. They need to start reporting that, because it's not like it's a secret to them. It's not as if these protesters are not telling them that, listen, this is what these people are doing. And I think it leads into these conversations like President Trump had, where, you know, when they asked him about systemic racism, he completely changes the subject and he tries to talk about this law and order nonsense. And I say this to people all the time, as I travel around the state of Wisconsin, do not get tripped up by somebody trying to change the subject on you. As Jamelia shared, racism, this is what I say about racism in America. Racism in America is as American as apple pie. It's built into the foundation of this country. You don't have to teach it to your children. America will teach racism to you just by living here. You don't even have to live here to learn American racism, because guess what? We show it in our television shows and our movies that we spread around the world. We spread American racism far and wide. And when it comes to what's happening with these counter-protesters, they are intentionally trying to get people to change the subject so that they don't have the conversation about systemic racism, about the things that need to change in this country. Because, listen, Black folks are tired of fighting the same battles over and over and over. We've been fighting these battles for 400 years, basically, 401 years, actually, since we were first brought here on slaving ships. And for people to now be in a position where they're acting surprised that racism is real in America, that systemic racism is real, that the police treat Black people differently, where have you been? You've had your head buried in the sand for so long. But this is what I believe very strongly as I travel around the country and talk to people, particularly white people. This is what they've been taught. They've been taught to be colorblind, to say that I don't recognize color. And I say, if you ever tell me that you're colorblind, I'm going to tell you that you are offending me by saying you're colorblind. You are literally disowning my entire history as a Black person in this country. You're saying that you don't agree that Black people have been treated differently. You know we are treated differently. You know that it's better to be a white person than to be any other person in this country. And then, you know, just as importantly, I think it's important for white people to understand that they have to be more courageous than they've been. If they are truly believers in anti-racism, racism can't be fixed by people of color. Black people can march till cows jump over the moon, and that will not make racism go away. Racism will go away when white people change, when white people are willing to challenge their friends and their coworkers and their neighbors and their police departments and their elected officials to do better. And I don't think enough white people are willing to do that. It's great that white people are out here protesting, you know, wearing Black Lives Matter T-shirts and hats and putting the signs in the yard. I'm very happy to see that, because it's never happened before. But that's the easy stuff. It's easy to do those things. It's much harder to sit around Thanksgiving dinner when Uncle Bob says that race is joking for you to say something to Uncle Bob about that and tell him that you're offended. It's really hard to go into your job knowing that they have discriminated against people of color, particularly Blacks, in employment, and then saying that we need to stop doing this. Those are the things that I want to see white people do. If you want to be a real ally, you have to do more than just talk. You have to follow it up with real actions. And when it comes to policing, I will say this until the day that I die. There is something fundamentally flawed with the way that we police in this country, because police officers kill over 1,000 people per year. They brutalize people constantly, consistently. And we as a society, we must be okay with it, because we don't complain about it until they murder somebody. Listen, it's not just about them murdering people. It's about them brutalizing, beating the crap out of people. We've seen the videos. There are no viral videos that, you know, you could spend an entire week watching those and not watching anything else. We have to fundamentally shift the way police officers are given a free rein to brutalize people, to try to control people physically when they don't have to. There's no reason that we should have to have so-called de-escalation training for police. They should not be escalating situations to begin with, but guess what? They're trained to escalate situations. They're trained to physically control people. They are trained to put hands on people, and there is something fundamentally flawed with that. And we know as black people, and particularly black males, I've had police point a gun at my head and threaten me at least a couple times during the course of my life. I don't know many of my friends who haven't had encounters with the police that ended very badly, with them being absolutely traumatized. And the trauma goes above and beyond that individual. The trauma of Jacob Blake, he's traumatized. His entire family is traumatized. His children are traumatized. Their neighbors are traumatized. Everybody that knows these people are traumatized. The entire black community, in many respects, are traumatized. And trauma is much worse when it is continuous, when it is a collective trauma that we're dealing with. We've been dealing with trauma in this country without any treatment since the day we got here. And so it's a much bigger issue. It causes premature death in our community. People keep trying to tell us that we're predisposed to high blood pressure. That is a lie. The reason we have high blood pressure at a rate higher than anybody else in America is because we're black. If you look at West Africa people don't have high rates of high blood pressure. And we are stressed all the time. And those are the things that white people need to begin to understand and really begin to have different conversations than the conversations they have, and not being allowed to be tripped up and diverted, their attention diverted to some other nonsense because people don't want to talk about systemic racism in a real way.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and then we'll ask Gregory to respond. That is Reggie Jackson. He's joining us from Milwaukee. Jamelia Land is joining us from Sacramento. And Gregory McKelvey is joining us from Portland. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will be talking about militias and far-right groups. According to several reports, the federal government has long ignored white supremacists, even though the FBI says they're the most lethal domestic terrorist threat to the U.S. Former FBI agent Michael German says they've infiltrated law enforcement agencies across the country. So what questions do you have? And what are their plans for the election? That is tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. If you'd like to join today's show, we're talking about why people are taking to the streets, the demands for racial justice, an end to police violence, and just really where we are today with so many people on the streets and then these white armed militia groups coming in the case of Kyle Rittenhouse allegedly shooting three and killing two. We're joined today by Reggie Jackson, senior columnist with the Milwaukee Independent. Jamelia Land is a children's mental health advocate who works with All of Us or None. Jamelia was a close friend of 22-year-old Stephon Clark, who was shot and killed by two police officers in his grandmother's yard in Sacramento in March 2018. Gregory McKelvey is vice chair of the Oregon Democratic Black Caucus and board president of Brown Hope. Gregory, Reggie also brought up so many points there. I'd love to get you to respond, but I also wanted to ask you, given what we've heard from Jamelia about, you know, white outsiders coming into Sacramento, same with Reggie. I mean, the sheriff's department there said the majority of the people arrested in Kenosha are from outside the city. And I just wanted to remind people in late July, I'm reading here from the Star Tribune, a masked man who was seen in a viral video smashing the windows of a South Minneapolis auto parts store during the George Floyd protests is suspected of ties with a white supremacist group and sought to incite racial tension. So what about Portland? What are you hearing there?
I mean, obviously, Portland is a majority white city. And so I think things, you know, might be a little different here. White people have been protesting in Portland for a very long time, but I still, I appreciate everything that was said, and I think it's something that the entire country is struggling with. It's an important discussion. Where I certainly agree on is that we should not allow people to change the subject. But when we talk about people coming from outside places, it's interesting to me that there are certain events where that is okay, but to come to the epicenter of a protest we then decide that's not okay. I mean, we saw women's marches across the entire nation where people were coming from the suburbs into major cities to protest Donald Trump. Obviously, we have the March on Washington. Many people from Portland went to the March on Washington as well. It's not surprising to me that people in neighboring areas would go to the epicenter of the protest when they have frustrations with their own police department as well. And, like, I condemn the violence and destruction and looting and stuff in the strongest terms, but I think we play into the narrative when we talk about it so much. I mean, I really don't want to talk or hear anything about anything other than Black lives. And not a single window or dumpster fire or, frankly, business is going to add up to the life of Stephon Clark or any of the people that are murdered by police. And I really think that we're doing a disservice ourselves if we spend so much of the conversation talking about something that is not what we're out there for. I mean, the history books are not going to read that there was the largest uprising in the history of America, at least since the Civil Rights era, and also some businesses were looted. They're going to write about the change that came from it. And riots have been a constant part of our nation's history, including white riots. And oftentimes those riots come hand in hand with progress that happens in our society. So I agree that the media does focus on this violence too much, but I would also say that both major parties are focusing on the violence as well. And the last thing is you can't control a protest. And we can't get into a thing where we're saying that protesters or anybody is allowing people to engage in the violence, because we're not out there in the streets to recreate a form of policing where people are going to police the way that they're outraged. And we spent a lot of this conversation talking about the evils of racism and the evils of how we police in this country. And it's hard for me to then say that there is no way that anyone's legitimate reaction to that racism we have been seeing would be destructive. That's just simply not true. And I also think there's a huge generational gap between the way that people are protesting or the way that people think is acceptable to protest. It's really, in my experience, mostly youth that engage in the most destructive aspects of these protests. And we have to understand that their lived experience and their formative experiences are so much different than any other generation. I mean, I grew up, as well as the Zoomers below me, grew up being told that this is the end of the world. We have 10 years left until it's the end. Capitalism is destroying the entire world, and you're not going to be able to have kids, and everything is going to be a wasteland. And so we can't then teach this in schools to every single kid accurately and then say that their reaction to being taught that for their entire lives is too destructive. To them, they're saying, I don't care if this business is burnt down because the people who own this gas station are burning down the entire world. And so there's this huge disconnect we have here, and I think there's legitimate disagreements and arguments over whether it's effective. And, of course, I side with the people on this call that I don't think it's effective, but I understand it. And I think we do a disservice to progress when we spend so much time talking about it.
Jamilia, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, we should mention that the piece I heard on NPR this morning, you know, in Kenosha, a lot of the businesses that were affected are independent. They're owned by people of color. Some neighborhood community members said this is where Black communities go to get their groceries, and now it's not there anymore. And, you know, people are hurting because of COVID, and then they're just getting hit twice. I mean, they said this is, you know, we condemn this, and we don't know who did this.
Well, if I can kind of, I'd like to address some of what was just said in addition to that. So around the Black businesses, I don't believe that those who are in the African-American community who may see those Black businesses or know that they are Black-owned are necessarily participating in that. And I can't speak to that because we don't see that demographic, or excuse me, we don't see that problem happening within our demographic here in California. We don't have as many Black-owned businesses in certain areas. Our communities have been so overly gentrified and economically depraved that the businesses that we frequent are not owned by anyone who look like us. But I'd like to go back a tad bit in this, and there were a couple of things that came up. So number one, around, you know, I heard someone mention de-escalation and training. I'd like to make a note that oftentimes when we're talking about these types of killings and this violence, we hear conversations around de-escalation. Well, I personally don't believe that de-escalation training is a necessity or even a real factor, because we know time and time again, at least those of us in the African-American community, we know that when it is an active white shooter going into a school, a church, business entities, shooting and killing a host of people, de-escalation is never an issue because we know that he's peacefully arrested. He may be taken to a restaurant for his favorite meal. When we see his mugshot, he's not all battered and bruised. We don't get to hear his whole history. What we hear is it's a mental health issue, that this poor young white child who's gone and killed other white children or blacks, he has a mental health issue. And so we're not afforded that same luxury, though, because we can just be unarmed. We oftentimes hear the clapback from the community. Well, if you just taught you all, your people, your children, to comply, this wouldn't happen. But we know that's not true, because there have been several instances where we have, in fact, complied, yet we've still been shot and killed. When you speak about, you know, why is it that law enforcement in this country continues to be able to kill with no impunity, is because of legislative pieces like the Police Officers' Bill of Rights that continue to reinforce and afford them levels of protection that us as everyday citizens are not afforded. And so what I'm asking my white allies to do is, I don't necessarily need you in the streets. I don't need you protesting or rioting. I definitely don't want you spray painting BLM on things, because there is a difference between the concept of Black Lives Mattering and having value versus an organizational structure called Black Lives Matter. What I need my white allies to do is, I need them to actually get out and start contacting their government officials. I need them to start applying pressure to legislators. Hey, if you are receiving funding from police unions, we need you to be transparent. I want you to send that money back. Let them know that they can no longer continue to buy your vote. That's what I need my white allies to do. There's also something very interesting that was just mentioned about the generational gap, the youth versus the elders. We are seeing that a lot of the youth today, it's a different demographic. We are talking about, there is a lot of children who are now, this isn't necessarily a black and white issue. We have a lot of biracial children. We have a lot of white parents who are looking at the fact for the first time. Now, they're just as scared as I am, because they have a brown child in their house, and they know that law enforcement is only going to see brown. They're not going to see their whiteness. And so for those, I am asking them, I need you to stand up and stand in the gap, too. I need you to have these conversations with people that you know very clearly, whether it's Uncle Bob at the dinner table or your employer or, you know, your childhood friend. I need you to stand up, stand in the gap, have these conversations. And then another thing is that the black violence versus the white violence. You know, we hear oftentimes in the community, one of the first things that I hear when I start talking about these police killings is, well, what about you guys killing yourself? What about black-on-black crime, black-on-black violence? And I'd like to note that language is very important, right? Language can either calm or incite. When you say black on black, it gives you a visual image in your mind. You see possibly two young black men. You may have an image in your mind of what they may be dressed like, what their hair may look like, the surrounding background, and then you see this violent exchange. But I find it interesting that when we have situations like Parkland, when it's a young white shooter, and he's going into a situation and he's killing a bunch of other young white children? Do we call that white-on-white crime? When we see Latinos, do we call it Latino-on-Latino crime? When we see Asians, do we call it Asian-on-Asian crime? No, we don't. But when it's black, it's black-on-black crime. And that is a part of continuing to fuel the narrative that my mere complexion makes me dangerous, makes me violent, makes me a threat to anyone in this country. And therefore, I am now further dehumanized, which makes it easier for people to initiate violence against me. I'm not safe anywhere I go. I can have a white woman, I can have a white male. Hell, in this country, a white child can accost me, and it's okay. But you let it be reversed, and you let a black person engage in this behavior. Now we must be manhandled. We must be dealt with violence. As a black woman, I feel as though I have it a little bit harder, because my fight every day is standing up and fighting for black men who are either being wrongfully incarcerated or who are having their lives taken at the hands of law enforcement, or trying to stand in the gap with community violence, specifically around community gun violence. And so, you know, we are tired. We are absolutely tired. This has been hundreds of years of trauma, and we are told to deal with it. As a black woman, I have to be cautious. I have to be cautious in how I engage people, because if I elevate my voice too much, or I become too animated with my gesturing or my facial expression, I may be considered an angry black woman. See that right there? Feeding into a stereotype that's been designed by somebody else to continue to keep me oppressed. But when I speak, and there's other spaces that I speak, and I articulate myself, and I carry myself in a different manner, I still catch hell, because, oh, wow, you're different. You're not like them. Who's them? Other black people who look like me? Because, well, you talk white. You sound white. What does that mean? Does that mean because I articulate myself in a certain fashion, that I have a good command of the English language, that somehow now I'm less of a threat? I mean, the subtle things that, you know, I had a lady in a nail shop, an Asian lady in a nail shop, come over to me and ask me about, at the time my daughter was 7, oh, is she white? I said, no. Oh, she talks white. She talks good. She sounds good. She talks white. And I was just so taken back by that, because I'm not a rarity. There are a lot of people who look like me, that sound like me, that do things like me. But that's not what the world wants to see. That's not what we talk about. What we talk about is the young black man in the neighborhood who may have dreadlocks in his hair and his pants are sagging and gold teeth in his mouth, and we don't understand how he got there. Furthermore, America does not want to take any responsibility as to what she has done, since we like to call America, you know, we like to give her call America by a feminine pronoun. We don't want to take responsibility for what America has actually done. Then we hear, well, you know, you people just need to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Well, hell, if I don't even have feet to have boots on, how am I going to pull myself up? This country has been built on our backs. And what do we get? We get relegated to the dark corner of thug, of criminal, of black, of everything that's not positive. But it's interesting to me that America continues to steal everything we have. Cultural appropriation is very real. We can't have anything. Our hair, our music, our performing arts, whether it's athletes, everything that we do, America takes and wants to make it their own and financially profit and benefit off of it. But we are overly incarcerated and we are gunned down. I still can't understand how it is that white America, I do understand, but I have to say that I can't. On the flip side of that, I can't understand how white America can continue to see this as it's okay. It's okay. You know, I was sent a video a few days ago, a young black man, 22-year-old, what's his name, Salatus Melvin. He was shot and killed by police officers in Orange County, Florida, and you hear the officer, the child is dead on the ground, eyes open, mouth open, not moving, not breathing, and the officer is standing over the kid, and he goes, "You're a bold nigger, ain't ya?"
You know, you just gave us a lot, Jamelia. I just want to get some final thoughts from Reggie just quickly. You're in Wisconsin, Reggie. We only have about a minute left, but you and I were talking yesterday about just the upcoming election and, you know, the important role that Wisconsin is going to play. Can you just talk, give us your thoughts about what's really at stake? You know, bringing this conversation kind of back and what's at stake in the upcoming election. Actually, we have about 30 seconds.
Well, we know that black people are going to be blamed if Donald Trump wins the election, just like we were blamed in 2016. We have to understand we're less than 7% of the population. We cannot be blamed for what happens in the presidential election in Wisconsin, because that narrative has been pounding black people for the last 4 years. We can't allow people to blame us when we passed voter ID laws specifically to make sure black people in Wisconsin could not vote. We cannot accept that responsibility, and we have to stop allowing people to blame us for that.
Well, as I said, Jacob Blake's family had a community gathering yesterday. They did voter outreach, and at the March on Washington on Friday, where tens of thousands of people from across the country came out to call for racial justice, they were also doing massive voter outreach. It didn't get much attention, but there were so many people there. Reggie Jackson is joining us from Milwaukee. Jamelia Land is joining us from Sacramento. And Gregory McKelvey is with us from Portland. Thank you all so much for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.